This is Floss Weekly. I'm Doc Searles, joined this week by Simon Phipps. We're talking with Wes Turner of the Rensselaer Center for Open Software, which is doing pioneering work on the way open source is taught in universities. That's coming up next. Floss Weekly is brought to you from LastPass Studios. Securing every access point in your company doesn't have to be a challenge. LastPass unifies access and authentication to make securing your employees simple and secure, even when they are working remotely. Visit LastPass.com/twit to find out how they can help.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWIT.
This is Floss Weekly, episode 590, recorded Wednesday, August 5th, 2020. Rensselaer Center for Open Software. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Hover. Do you have a domain name that truly represents you and your passion? Visit hover.com/twit to get 10% off your first purchase of any domain extension for the entire first year. And by Barracuda. Did you know that 91% of all cyber attacks start with an email? To uncover the threats hiding in your Office 365 account, get a secure and free email threat scan at barracuda.com/floss. Hi, everybody. I'm Doc Searles, and welcome to Floss Weekly. I'm joined this week by Simon Phipps, the great webmink himself. And we'll be talking to Wes Turner of the Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute and ARCOS, its Center for Open Source, Open Software. Really interesting topic. So where are you on Earth, Simon? I know, I could guess. It looks
bad. I am once again in my lair on the edge of the woods here in Southampton. And it has been a beautiful summer so far. We've had blue skies. The rain has been spread out, so there's almost none. We've got a great crop of vegetables from the market garden. Things are pretty good, although I gather that the rest of the world is going to hell in a handbasket. But I don't ever leave the property, so I don't really know about that.
That handbasket's actually always been there, I think.
Right, right.
That's what it does. It just swings. So I am in what the Brits call Los Angeles, which is also a language, I suppose.
I could never speak that.
I know you can't. It's where every other word is like, I suppose. This is it's overcast today. We call this the marine layer, and I'm in a borrowed layer for the next two or three weeks. Then I'm back to my office in Santa Barbara, so. So thanks for being with us, and looking forward to talking to Wes Turner. But first we get this thing. I have to move things around on my screen.
So you need a bigger screen.
it's the biggest one, but it's never big enough to talk about our sponsor, which I'm actually quite fond of. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Hover. Create a domain name that truly represents you and your brand. Hover has over 400 domain name extensions to choose from. When you build your brand online, no matter what you want to build, there's a domain name waiting for it. It's a jumping off point for many entrepreneurs, and they want you to start your business with a domain name that truly showcases who you are. You'll find excellent technical support available to answer any questions you might have. Their tech support team never upsells you. They only work hard to keep you online. And I speak from personal experience on this. I had many domains scattered across many providers over many years, and I brought them all inside Hover several years ago, and their work to make that happen was just way above and beyond the call of duty. So what Hover also has is free Whois privacy protection, a clean and easy to navigate UX and UI, monthly sales on popular top level domains. It's not hard to see why Hover is a popular place for people starting all kinds of businesses. So keep your domain name separate from hosting. They do that too, and giving you the flexibility to choose the right platform for your business. So again, use a domain name that truly represents you and your passion. Visit hover.com/twit to get 10% off of your first purchase of any domain extension for the entire first year. That's hover.com/twit for 10% off your domain extension for a full year. And we thank Hover for their support. So, so welcome. Our guest this week is Wes Turner. He's a senior lecturer in the Department of Computer Science at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, also known as RPI, and the director of the Rensselaer Center for Open Source there. And your CV is so long and impressive, Wes, that I'm not even going to bother to go too far into it. I think we've got too much to talk about on the show. But maybe you could give us a kind of general impression on where you come from when you took over RCOS at RPI.
Sure. When I graduated college with my doctorate, I started working for GE, and they actually started some open source software called VTK, Visualization Toolkit. And it's used by a lot of niche markets to do visualizations of different types of data, PDEs, you know, airflows over surfaces. But as part of this, they started getting drawn into other open source projects like NLM. National Library of Medicine started the Insight Toolkit for segmentation and registration to do exploitation of medical images. And GE was a big supporter of that, as were a consortium of companies, including another small company in our area, Kitware. So from about 2000 on, I've been working with and in open source software from a commercial standpoint. These were actual businesses making money off of both supporting and using open source software in their industries. This kind of culminated back in the early 2010s with me working as a member of Kitware for a group called OSERA, the Open Source Electronic Health Record Agent. This was spawned off by the Veterans Administration to try and make their electronic health record open, public, and easily maintainable. They were running out of developers who were able to do the work they needed to do, and they wanted to both benefit the broader community and also to get some of the pitchback from, you know, industry in helping them to maintain their own open source. So I was the director of open source operations there for a while, and you know, after a while, I ended up coming out from that environment and joined RPI Rensselaer as a lecturer, and immediately fell into this Rensselaer Center for Open Source position under a friend of mine, Professor Mukai Krishnamurthy. He's since retired, so I kind of assumed the directorship. And so it's been a long road of going through and getting more and more involved with open source over the years, really from a very pragmatic commercial standpoint. So I've come to appreciate not only the philosophical underpinnings of open source software, but also, you know, the pragmatic commercial applications for actually doing business in the real world.
Yeah, it's interesting to me that you mentioned GE and your area. You're in upstate New York, and I think I've always thought, and maybe because I'm a techie, that I've thought of your part of the world as one of the, not so much a satellite of Silicon Valley, but a predecessor of it. I mean, one of the areas where tech has been thick on the ground, and I'm wondering to what degree you're in, you know, your project is involved directly with the businesses in the area there.
So we encourage mentors from different businesses. We don't have as much of a buy-in to the local, you know, big businesses as I would like. I do impose on people from GE, people from Kitware, people from basically any industry that I can reach out to that do open source software or have a connection to open source software to come in and talk to us, give us seminars. But we don't have any formal commitments within the area. We have worked with Red Hat before. They were a big supporter. We work with Mozilla, but these are more global organizations. Now, on the other hand, Arcos has a very entrepreneurial bent. We try to teach students open source software. We try to teach them software development. You know, we try to teach them how to teach themselves new technologies because they're given a lot of freedom in the types of projects they go after. But we also work very closely with the Entrepreneurial Center at Rensselaer, Severino Center is its formal name, and with the Archer Leadership Center. So a lot of our projects leave Arcos, and they at least make a shot at becoming a commercial enterprise. We've had a few successes. We had a plugin for Chrome that was very successful for a while, and then Chrome changed its module kind of organization, and that fell off. I have a group right now working on something called automatic door control, who are trying to come up with alternate methods for, you know, the big blue buttons on the sides of buildings to allow handicapped or restricted access. We had some restricted access people who noticed that they were always placed poorly. They came up with a project to host an app on Android or iOS and then attach hardware to these doors so they could open it as they neared the door without having to actually physically come up next to the button. So that's, you know, currently they're trying to spin that out into a business. So we have lots of contacts with small local businesses, you know, some of whom go away pretty fast and some of whom, you know, stick around for a while. We try to maintain as much as possible larger connections, mainly through, you know, a network of people that the faculty and I know. Not as much as formal as we'd like.
So you talk there about the students being involved in these projects. How is this integrated in with the curriculum at RPI?
So we are a bit of a hybrid or a chimera. I've talked to different organizations, you know, like Mozilla, like Red Hat, and we seem to be a little bit unique. Arcos is an umbrella over a student organization combined with a curriculum. We like to think of ourselves as enabling a large number of our students to do independent projects. So, you know, essentially I have a network of undergraduate programming mentors who kind of form a hierarchy. And we allow students to come in every semester, sign up for essentially independent study or research credits, submit a proposal for what they would like to do. Oftentimes that will be an extension to a proposal for a project that's ongoing so that they continue on the project that's been already founded. And then for the next 15 weeks of the semester, we help them learn what they need to learn in order to attack that project. You know, we're often the first people on campus to adopt new technologies. Docker came into RPI campus, you know, largely from my viewpoint through Arcos, needing to explore that for better ways to deploy complex projects complex web projects with servers and clients, et cetera. But during the semester, then they'll work on these projects. They'll keep us updated with status reports, with commit logs, with presentations. They'll attend bonus sessions, which are essentially mini seminars given by, you know, either myself, another faculty, or oftentimes by the students themselves. In fact, most often by the students themselves, where they explore different topics, bring new introduce new technologies to the group and to the community. And then at the end of the semester, we say that Arcos is the one course that you are actually allowed to fail. We don't mean that you can fail the course. I mean, you can fail the course, but we don't mean that we want you to fail the course. What we mean is you came into us with a proposal, and then you did development for 15 weeks. We all know how software goes, right? You start out with an idea. You think you know what you're doing. 3 weeks in, you find out that you're using the wrong technology. You didn't really understand what the user needed. You didn't understand how hard it was to do things. We look at their progress over the entire semester. We look at how they reacted to setbacks. We look at, you know, their actual effort, or try to look at their actual effort instead of just grading them on, you said you're going to do this, you only got this done, so, you know, you obviously did poorly. So it's a way of, you know, it's largely independent study, not the easiest thing to grade, because we do actually have to go in and look pretty closely at what students are doing.
So has that really been difficult to do with the COVID pandemic going on, or was everything remote before? Have you had a problem with not being able to actually look over their shoulder and pat them on the back?
That is an excellent question. In some ways, you're exactly right. We were always not online. I mean, we were always, in person. We have small groups during the week. We divide up. We have a fairly large student body taking the course. In fall and spring, it can be 200 students. So we divide them up into small groups. We put them in, 8 or 10 different rooms. And then I would physically walk around and talk to everybody at least once a week, try to hit half the rooms per week and try to at least get a three-liner from every student as to, make sure they're on track, et cetera. So we've always been very hands-on. And I'm finding that lack to make my job more difficult. It's harder for me to know what the students are doing. It's harder for me to keep track of things. It's harder for me to have a good feel of, who's doing well and who needs me to step in and kind of give them, the added push or advice or something to move them along. But on the counterpoint to that, right, open source software is frequently done like this. You don't necessarily have this in-person meetings. The biggest communities, the R community has their Use R conference. The biggest communities do meet together. They have conferences. They get to know one another. They talk. But most of your work is done online and anonymously from everybody else. So in some ways, this COVID is actually a more realistic experience than previous. But at the same time, we don't want to throw them into the deep end and just force them to sink or swim. We want to be there, helping them out, being their introduction and getting them through the difficult parts. So it's got pluses and minuses, pretty much like everything else. But it's a good experience for them.
So, how do they find the projects to work on? Do you have a list of things that you would like done? Like every college professor wanting to get students to do his home chores, or do you work with communities like the LibreOffice community who have an easy hacks list that you can draw from? Where do projects come from?
I think the real answer to that is yes. They come from everywhere. We're very lenient on what projects the students can do. I try to encourage them to work on external projects just because that's a different experience than working on something that's just limited, to a more campus role. We have projects that come in externally. Right now, we are actually actively running ARCOS this summer. We have a project called Levigo, which comes to us from Albany Medical Center and has participation from Columbia University. This is a response to COVID, where they're trying to do a easy inventory system for hospitals on, COVID-related items. The investigators came to us and said, we're looking for some students who can help us to roll up a website with a database and some other, nice GUI touch and feel, iOS and Android. I think they've started with Android primarily right now. So that came to us from outside. That's actively being worked on. They've made some tremendous progress. They gave me a demo of it, last week, and they're scanning things and keeping inventory of face masks and gloves and all the, hand sanitizer, et cetera. So that's a project that came to us from outside. I really love those projects because those projects kind of offload some of the mentoring capabilities or requirements from our team and puts them onto an external customer, which benefits the students and, actually benefits me as well, because I don't have to worry about those guys. I know they're doing some good work because I get the reports from the mentors. We also have students come to us with their own projects. One of our long-running projects, a thing called YAKS, Yet Another Course Scheduler, was founded in 2015 because the students didn't like our student information system. So they've been working on this continuously since 2015. For the last 4 years, 3.5 years, it's been the primary way that most students plan their schedule for the semester. So we've had a continuing development for, over 5 years on that. And then we have professors coming to us as well. Another big project of ours is something called Submity, which is a homework grader slash course environment, LMS type of facility that we use largely in the computer science project to auto grade our homework assignments. That's been worked on since 2014 under the auspices of Professor Barbara Cutler here. You know, it's part of what she's been doing work on. She needed people to continue working on it, and she's been doing a wonderful job for us mentoring for, you know, 5 or 6 years now.
I would think that there are two kinds of work that must be front and center for you now and for your students. One is because you're dealing with it. One is COVID, COVID-related mm-hmm. stuff, and building whatever open source level infrastructure or just hacks that might be helpful with that. And the other is what you're already talking about, you know, with the course scheduler and the other work, where you're kind of rebuilding the academy from the inside out. And I'm wondering to what extent that's true, and also promulgating outside your own sphere with Arcos and with the university.
Getting things off of the university campus is one of my major, I'd like to say goals, but that's one of the things that I try to push. You know, unfortunately, it's really difficult because students kind of think relatively narrowly. So something like Submity that has a lot of support from a faculty member has managed to be installed at RPI in the computer science department. It's now been installed at the ECSC department at RPI, and it's also been used at King's College, Walla Walla College, and the Sapienza Universite de Roma. So some of our stuff does get off. I would like to see it happen more often. You know, that's one of the things that with an academic focus, with a campus focus, is not as obvious or is not as easy to do as you'd expect. But we do work pretty closely with, you know, there's a teaching open source group, Posse, all sorts of academic open source to try to move these things off campus. And I think if we had a 5-year plan, that's really where I would like to focus in. But you're right, as far as the rest of it, a lot of it is very student-centered. You know, these are the needs we have as students. And by the way, YAX was actually, we were trying to get that into NYU at one point, but unfortunately, you have this thing called graduation, and the NYU students graduated, and then our students graduated, and then the next set of NYU students graduated, and we never quite made it to a full deployment. But yeah, I think that's, you know, kind of our efforts to get off campus are not as successful as I'd like. They're not unsuccessful. Like I said, we have some spinoff companies that have come and at least existed for a while. We have ADC going out. We have a project called Venue that's for remote attendance, right, which is kind of in this whole COVID niche. They actually pivoted. They were doing something a little bit different. They adapted their technology for remote attendance to help out with people who are either attending lectures remotely after the fact, you know, taped lectures, or, you know, a mixture of taped lectures and live lectures, and they can include poll questions and you know, different interactions to improve the student experience while they're actually being online instead of in person. And again, then we have things like Levigo. We've had some other explorations of COVID data that have been instituted.
I'm wondering if your graduates, you mentioned, you know, that things kind of get terminated when people graduate to some degree, and there's always this turnover. To what extent they continue to work on some of these things afterwards, or come back as mentors, or stay involved in one way or another?
That's a great question, because that's where we get a lot of our, you know, we worry about, you know, we have a cycle. Every 4 years, you lose everybody. But for Yaks, for example, one of the I think it was the second generation. They started about a year or two after Yaks actually started. They've actually continued. They graduated a year and a half ago. They've actually continued to work with us and actually be the voice of the mentor. They're one of the people that's been driving to try to find a way to commercialize this, find a way to bring it out of our campus. But in doing that, they've been working with the Axe team extensively for the last, since they graduated, year and a half, 2 years. And those types of relationships that we build, a lot of students take courses and then just forget about them. ARCOS is a class, because it's an independent study, they can take it more than one time. And while they're taking it, or, even after they're done taking it for credit, they can continue to work with us either as a student and be one of our mentoring, tutoring group, or, as they graduate, they are welcome to come back and work with us. And we've had a lot of students who do that. The person from Yaks is one of those. We've had people on, one of the projects was Why Not Change Your Clothes? It was a student who decided that more of his underclass brothers should know how to wash their clothes. So he put up monitors for the washing machines. And he mentored that for about three or four semesters afterward until it was finally retired for lack of additional washing machines, I guess.
So how do the students find you, Wes? I mean, are you listed as a course in the catalog, or do they come on campus and discover you exist, or do you advertise, or do you send out people with nets? I mean, how do they find you?
So if you're a computer science major, we are listed in the catalog. It's kind of it says ARCOS, so there's not really, if you're going through the catalog, unless you know what we are, you don't really get a good feel for what we're doing. But we are in the catalog. Most of the computer science students will stumble upon us eventually. But in some of our more successful semesters, and by successful, it's not necessarily the number of people we get, but we would love to have more of a diversity. How an open source project, you need people who can do code, but you also need people who can design. You need people who can imagine a GUI, people who can test. And these are all disciplines that aren't necessarily core to the CS curriculum, right? We have HCI, Human Computer Interface, classes out of our humanities department. So in our more successful semesters, we've had our students go out and kind of evangelize us. They talk to their friends. They bring in their more humanities-driven friends on the artist side. They set up shop in the club fair that they have every fall at RPI, and they just reach out and try to get in these people that aren't core CS. And those have been some really great semesters. We brought in some really good designers. I've had one of our designers, instead of having a project, I just had her freelance. And just, I asked, please go from project to project and just help them make a good design, because, the best software in the world without an understandable GUI and without some attention being paid to the aesthetics is not going to be that successful. We are there in the catalog. That's one of our benefits for being this kind of course offering. But at the same time, we are shameless evangelists, and we send our students out, and they meet with all of the incoming freshmen. They're part of the introduction to campus life for at least the CS department, and we're trying to expand that.
Right. And tell me about the results of this. Have you had people leave the course and become superstar programmers, or start spin out companies, or what have the consequences been for it?
So we've had some of that. We've been going since 2006, I guess, so about 14 years now. And we've had some people who have gone on to be good entrepreneurs. We haven't hit the jackpot with
no unicorns yet.
Zuckerberg, yeah, exactly. But we've done well, and there are a lot of people who are working. But the major impact, the more solid impact that I see is simply that this is a way for students to explore other things than what they get in the normal coursework. And what you find is that some of our best students are not the students who are getting the best grades. So, they're people that come in with a curiosity and with a fearlessness that you can't learn from textbook learning. So everything's open source. We require our students to use Git. They can use GitLab or GitHub or, self-publish if they'd like. But it has to be there. It has to be open. It has to be licensed appropriately. And because of that, it's an online resume, right? I mean, they can they can point somebody to what they've done, and they can immediately see the quality of the work they've done, the effort they've put in. And of course, if they have done very little, they can see that as well. But what we found is that some of our students who are, you know, maybe low B students do exceptionally well and get really good job offers because of the knowledge, the breadth of knowledge they can show, because they've explored topics that interest them, and because of the fact that they can demonstrate that they are able to develop in an environment that really matches, you know, what you see in industry quite a bit now.
Right. Now, it isn't the case that open source is primarily a philanthropic activity, but it does turn out that it has attributes that are really good for philanthropic activities. Mm-hmm. Do you encourage your students to go out and do things like, I happen to know that in Albany there is a Computers for Kids program that's been run by the general manager of Open Source Initiative, where it would be great to have some of these people working. Do you encourage them to go out and volunteer in some of these activities as well?
So we often bring in those groups to talk to us. I know Patrick Masson, by the way. He comes and talks. Yes. He's one of our standard. he talks to us about IP and licensing and about, you know, the general good of open source almost every semester. So we haven't been involved with that one, but we have done things with, for example, Coding in Community. It took me a second to pull that out. Coding in Community is a group of high school and college students, mainly college students, who run tutorial classes every Saturday during the school year for, you know, disadvantaged students, areas, schools in our area that don't actually have access to computing resources. And a lot of students from our group actually wrote curriculum as part of an open source project. So the entire course is online. They were extending it with projects. They were borrowing shamelessly from CS1, which is great. You know, it makes CS1 easier, and it makes us feel better about publishing our notes there as well. And they did a lot of work with helping to generate this Coding for Community. We do try to bring in these types of organizations. We do encourage them very well, but we don't require it. Sometimes we get kind of silly projects, and sometimes we get projects like that one or like Levigo, where they're actually trying to do things to help hospitals in the area combat COVID. We encourage it strongly. We don't require it. I think that's a good match between allowing the students to kind of choose their own destiny and trying to build this type of philanthropic community that you're talking about.
But what's the hardest thing to teach about open source? There must be something.
So there are several things that are hard to teach. One of the things that I find hard to teach is that you don't have to close your source to make money. So we had some projects that left. They were licensed under very liberal, you know, very permissive licenses, which actually allowed the students to change the license when they left. And, you know, all that does is close off any innovation from outside. So, you know, just teaching people that this is not just a hobby, you know, this is not just something you have to give away and donate, but it's also something where you can actually make a living, where you can work for a company like Red Hat, you know, where you're actually physically giving away software and you can still pay your bills and buy groceries. That's one thing that's kind of tough to teach. And it's something that we keep harping on quite a bit. The other thing that's tough to teach is the concept of, you know, we were talking about trying to get things off campus. And that's one of my goals every semester, is to get more projects off campus, because, you know, that's really how a community grows. It doesn't grow by being isolated within one college campus. So, no matter how successful it is on that campus. So one of the things that's really hard to talk to the students about is to talk to them about this concept of, you know, find what you're interested in and then find out what this has in common with, you know, 100 different things. So that instead of building a one-off tool, you know, your grapefruit segmenter that could only do one job. Let's build ourselves a general purpose tool that we can then migrate out, and we can have a broader view and kind of figure out how to make this grow and explode and become our unicorn.
After 14 years, I mean, I'm looking online here to see if you have a list. Do you have a list of like successes and failures you can learn from, and that's sort of a portfolio of work that's out there that you can point at and say, mm-hmm. this is ours, and or just learn from, say, you know, that worked fine until the dude left or whatever. I'm wondering if as you look back over the corpus of work that you've done, what, you know, how that persists in the world or what you're learning from it.
Well, we never mark a project as failed. Mm-hmm. It's always at a minimum a learning experience. But yeah, on our webpage, we have a list of projects, and the current projects are things that are being worked on, you know, in this semester. And then there's a little button you can click and it'll give you all the past projects. I think the last time I counted, we had 387 or so unique projects listed there. And we also had 1,336 unique developers listed there. So, you know, we do keep that list of things. Maybe I have to change my last answer, though. You know, you asked what the hardest thing to do is. To convince students to go back and look at that is also very hard. I will go, you know, we've had a number of projects to do. Let me think of they wanted to do not course scheduling, but to figure out semester by semester. So not just for a single course or for a single semester, but plan your entire RPI coursework. And we've had four or five of them, and they run for a semester or two, and then the people get bored and drop them. Or you know, graduate or something, and they haven't been picked up. And then the next group comes in and rolls their own. And you know, I'll go and I'll say, look at these three projects. These projects, you know, they're available online. You can get to them. You can get to all their code. It's all published. You know, please go, and you don't have to do these projects. You don't have to extend these projects, but you should at least look at why they failed, or why they're no longer being worked on, or where they got to, and what problems they come up against, so that you can better plan what you're going to do. And we keep the data. It's out there. Getting students to actually go back and look at that, even when they're given explicit pointers, is also kind of tough. You'll get, you know, everybody, if you tell somebody to do something, they will do it. How much they incorporate that into their planning is more questionable.
So thanks. I need to jump ahead here and say this episode of Floss Weekly is also brought to you by Barracuda. Barracuda is the provider of cloud-enabled enterprise-grade security solutions that protect email, networks, data, and applications. Because suddenly you have dozens, hundreds, or maybe thousands of employees working remotely, each one of them getting tons of emails every day, making them vulnerable. 91% of all cyber attacks start in an email. Spear phishing, ransomware, account takeover, conversation hijacking. Multiply that by how many employees times how many emails. One click on the wrong email can cost you money, customers, and your reputation. Barracuda researchers have seen a steady increase in the number of coronavirus-related spear phishing attacks since January, and they have observed a recent spike of 667% in this type of attack just since the end of February. Get the protection you need for your company with Barracuda Total Email Protection. It includes all-in-one email security, backup and archiving, AI-based protection from spear phishing, account takeover, and business email compromise, an annotated incident response that gives you options to quickly and efficiently address attacks, security awareness training to educate your workforce so your employees could be the first line of defense against attacks. There are so many. I mean, every day I know I see, and I don't know who to tell about these things that I see are consistent, that are coming, that are clearly spear phishing attacks. I think spear phishing, in my own experience, is one of the most prevalent and obvious forms of those. So right now there are new attacks impersonating organizations like the World Health Organization. Attackers utilize domain spoofing and promise information relating to the coronavirus in an attempt to trick users into a phishing scam. So ensure the safety and security of your business with Barracuda. Uncover threats hiding in your inbox. Get a secure free email threat scan for your Office 365 account risk-free at barracuda.com/floss. That's barracuda.com/floss. Barracuda, your journey secured.
Well, that's all very exciting, but let's get back to Wes Turner. And Wes! So that was a very real-world sort of thing that we're talking about there, mm-hmm. about how you protect yourself against malware. How real do you think the open-source experience you give your students is? Is it the real thing, or do you think that when they graduate out into outside world open source projects, things are completely different for them?
So it's as real as they make it, I think, is the answer. We have some students who, you know, do the motions. You have to keep beating them around the gong to say, keep making sure you are licensed correctly, make sure you've participating in some type of planning process, an online scrum or something. But for those who actually, who actually participate fully, the experience seems to be pretty good, at least based on the testimonials I've gotten. I get, letters and emails all the time from our previous students who say, and this is a little bit of self-promotion for Arcos, not for me. But let's say that the most lifelike course that they took in their stay at RPI was essentially Arcos, and that they learned more from just going through and working in the open source activities than they learned in most of their other courses, including some of our design courses. I think that's a little bit of an overstatement. I think, it's really important to know the basics. I'm a big theorist. I think that we need to know the theory of computer science to do it well. But as far as the experience goes, I think it's pretty good, particularly on our better run projects. We have projects where we have an experienced student mentor, not even an external mentor, who runs a very tight meeting. It's what we encourage. We have them give seminars on how to do it. They'll run an agile process. They'll keep issues. They'll keep features in an issue tracker. They'll, maintain active canvassing of the issue tracker for feature requests and issues, problems that come up. And they'll make sure that their group is running, in that kind of business-like open source world mode. And I think that when we can get that going, and it doesn't always happen, but it happens more frequently than you would think. When we get that going, we have a very good track record. And I get notes back from those students saying, what a great time they had and how important it was for them.
Right, right. And what's it like running this course? Because, this sounds like a very atypical academic course. It sounds like you might well get people with a more research bent wondering why you're doing something so hands-on and practical. What do you find is difficult about organizing Arcos?
I'm terrified most of the time. we start out at the beginning of the semester, and I have spring and fall semesters. We'll have fall. It's generally a little over 200. Spring, it's a little under 200. Summer, it's turning out to be about 80. So we'll have all these students, and we'll have no projects. I'll be encouraging people who worked last year to come in and pitch their project. The first 2 weeks of class are students coming in either with new ideas or returning students from existing projects and giving an elevator talk. And then we'll also bring in like the Levago people, Albany Medical Center people. We brought them in virtually. Well, we brought everybody in virtually because of COVID. But we'll bring them in and we'll have them give their pitches. And we'll go through 30 to 40 pitches a minute to 2 minute long, and then we'll go have what we call, you know, variously depending on the semester, either project person pairing or speed dating. I think that speed dating is a colloquialism invented by the students. And we'll take all of those presenters and we'll give them signs, and they'll kind of stand up in the front of the room, and our students kind of disperse and go and talk to them and pick their projects. And that's the start of the semester. And I never know what's going to happen at that point. I never know what projects are going to be selected. I don't know what we're going to be working on. And, you know, that's kind of, it takes a lot of, you have to let go a lot in this course. You know, I can do grading, I can do, you know, mentoring, I can do advising, but that being able to let go and let students make choices and then wait for the end of the semester to actually show up and see that something reasonable got done. You know, I'm terrified in the start of the semester. At the end of the semester, you know, 3 weeks before, I think nobody's getting anything done. And then we do our final presentations and our grading. And it's like, wow, we really accomplished something this year. And, you know, that's kind of where things stand for me. And that's kind of the difficulty about the semester is you start off in terror. And during the semester, you have limited impact. You know, I can reach out to students. I can talk to students. I can, you know, look at their status reports. I can look at their problems, you know, where they're being stuck. And I can offer all sorts of encouragement. But they're self-learning at this point, and I can only do so much to improve that. And then you come back to the end and you get to see, wow, you know, something actually happened and this is really great. And look at these cool projects.
So I have a question that's a little bit sideways, but in sure. Broaden things out. You and I talked about this a bit on the phone several days ago. I'm kind of a planetary gear on the edge of like five different universities, including one in Southampton and in Simon's neighborhood. And the whole, I mean, we're at a moment right now in time where one of the industries that's most impacted, that's most threatened really by what we've done to fight this pandemic is colleges and universities. And I'm wondering from your perspective, how you see this going. It doesn't have to be confined to just your work with Arcos or with RPI, but you're on the inside and watching how, I mean, we're in a whole new world here. And Scott Galloway at NYU published a really comprehensive giant spreadsheet of variables that at the end of it, it says like well, one quarter of these colleges are going to die. And so I'm wondering where you see things going. And there's no right answer here, but I'm wondering where you, as you look outside your own institution, what's going on in the world out there?
So this is a very timely and difficult question, I'll give you my perspective, but I'm not going to require anybody to sign up to it other than me. you know, for Arcos, we kind of talked about this being a two-edged sword. You know, in some ways, it's making the experience more real. You know, these are things that happen in real life. You know, I worked remotely for, you know, 18 months at one point, meeting up with a group once every 3 or 4 months. So this is not atypical of where you're going to go in business. Lots and more jobs, particularly in our type of industry where you can, you know, you sit and type on a computer all day. You don't really need to see anybody except via Skype. You know, that's certainly something that's going to impact RPI, it's going to impact all colleges. I teach a couple of different courses. I teach this course. I teach CS1, which is, you know, a huge influx of freshmen. And I teach, you know, some other upper level, you know, smaller courses. And what I'm seeing mostly is that, you know, the value add to being in person is the ability to do this personal touch. I find it much harder to keep in contact with my audience, with the students in my classes when I'm doing it remotely, because, you know, I don't get any feedback. I don't hear the noises. I can't see the people yawning or you know, sitting, you know, watching me intently. So there's not really a good way to judge going, you know, out just how, you know, how well you're reaching your students. And I think that's really one of the big drawbacks to this all online thing is as a professor, you know, I've set the throttle, and I've got a hold of the steering wheel, and I'm driving right down the center of the road at the speed that I think is appropriate, and hoping that I'm hitting the students. Whereas before, I could get the feedback, and I would know when we get off topic, and I can go out and help and go sideways a little bit to change the lecture or to readdress material that is apparent isn't being I'm not presenting in a way that they're able to understand it initially. And that changes from year to year and class to class. You know, the things that one class picks up immediately, sometimes the other classes have difficulties with. So that kind of feedback, I think, is a critical part of what an in-person class offers. Now, the problem is when you get away from that. Oh, go ahead.
Sorry. Oh, no, go ahead. I was just, you really see the in-person thing is absolutely critical in the long run.
I think it's most efficient. Now here's the problem, right? Now we're in an environment where we're forced to work without that. And it turns out that no one's as happy about it, but we're doing as effective job as we can. Where I see this impacting my classes in particular is, well, I have a big group of incoming freshmen. I'm teaching CS1 this next semester, a big group of incoming freshmen who aren't going to have that first semester to gel and form cohesive support groups. But the material is going to be the same, and we're going to offer more online time. We're going to do kind of a flipped classroom type of thing where, you know, the lecture's published and then they can come in and ask us questions during the actual lecture time. So, you know, it's hard to argue that isn't going to work, but it's not going to be as efficient, and it's not going to be as much fun, and you're not going to build the same connections that you build by being on campus. Does that kind of...
Yeah, that's good. I mean, we're in this world where we're almost doing a controlled study between the world where we're in a room where we're all breathing the same air and where there's no social distancing and there's an understanding that people, you know, rub against each other and shake hands and look each other in the eye and read body language and are the social beings that we've been ever since, you know, we came down out of the trees. Mm-hmm. And then on the other hand, there's this new world we have where we're all in little rectangles, you know? So, and it's an interesting thing that, like I mentioned earlier, you know, basketball players are now not just basketball players. They're these guys that walk around with rectangles and then play basketball when they're not, you know, so, and that's a different world. I mean, I'm talking to my grandkids, they live on their rectangles but they still, you know, they still play, they still do sports, they still jump around, they still go to class. It's a struggle for them and their mother, who is a college professor, you know, and is a teacher trying to get them to learn things while they're at home, and the temptation of the rectangles is absolute. Right. So it's like, because in the world of rectangles, you have infinite distraction. Whereas when you're sitting in a room, and you're looking at the teacher, and you got a book, or you've got your computer in front of you. Still, maybe it's an open computer. But I mean, I remember Clay Shirky at NYU had this thing where he'd say to the class, "Okay, close your lids. You know, now we're talking, right?" And you can't do that when you're on Skype or Zoom or whatever else it is. You know, So it's an interesting time.
Mm-hmm. I do tell my students to watch the lectures at double speed, or at least 1.5 speed. I said, ignore the chipmunk.
Yeah, that's what happens with podcasts. So we're getting down toward the end of our hour here. So I think Simon might have one last question before we go into our final.
Yeah. So I was quite interested by that, Wes. You've been doing this for a long time, and I'm not really aware of any other university where there is a course like this. I don't know if you are. And I talk a lot with Patrick Masson about how we can get open source into higher education, and you know what we can do to make it spread. And I wonder, from your experience, what would you advise your peers to do to bring open source into the higher education curriculum? What should they be doing? or if you prefer, why isn't it happening?
Good questions. So I do actually work with a group called Teaching Open Source, and they run a thing called Posse, which is Professors of Open Source Software Experience or something like that. And we have these discussions. So there are outfits out there that are exploring this. One of the things, you know, one of the reasons that I think this doesn't pick up is it's not a traditional course, and it's really hard. We were fortunate that we got a nice grant from an alum to start up Arcos. Sean O'Sullivan gave $2 million to get us started. And because of that, we had this momentum. We had buy-in from the administration, and we kind of evolved from a student club into this kind of class student hybrid. And I think, you know, without that impetus, without that original gift, that may not have happened. And we had a lot of professors here who were interested in open source. So it kind of came at the right time and in the right way. I think the best thing you can do is, you know, start finding a group of students who are interested and then start petitioning to have this as part of the curriculum. You know, we teach software development and design, you know, which is, you know, go through the requirements, do some agile sprints, you know, talk to users. That's a perfect course. I mean, all that's missing is the open source part. I think part of the other thing of this is, you know, we oftentimes try to pick a specific course or a specific open source project and force the students to contribute. And if you're trying to contribute externally, there are barriers. You know, we work on different schedules. You know, the academic semester is people get started up in the first couple of weeks, then they work for a few weeks, and then they wrap it up, and you may never see them again. So they have this very finite time to get their work done. And some of the open source communities that you tend to join don't have the same rhythm. So, you know, you may come on and it may be 3 months before you've built up enough credibility in order to be contributing. And then, you know, you're trying to get stuff done for your class. You don't have any credibility to contribute. The guy who's in charge, you know, maybe he's on vacation during part of that. You're not getting any feedback. You're not getting responses to your requests, and you're not really bought into the community. It's hard to just come into these. I'm not faulting open source communities, by the way. You know, it's tough to accept some new person coming in and immediately wanting to contribute before you've made sure that they know, you know, what they're doing, that they buy into the standards of the group, et cetera. But these, they're on different rhythms. You know, they're on different marching tunes. You know, the structure of a semester doesn't necessarily map into the structure of an open source project. So, you know, I think one of the things you need to do is just, you know, start up, start doing it. And the other thing you need to do is kind of allow your students to be creative and allow them to kind of come up with the projects that they want to do. And I think this kind of helps get through this impedance mismatch between the real world and what's actually possible on campus. I would love to see more places do this.
Do you ever get involved in Google Summer of Code or Season of Docs?
So Google Summer of Code, I don't personally get involved with, submitting one of our, you know, our homework submission server that's been going on since 2014, I think it was, it said. You know, they've done Google Summer of Code for three straight semesters, and they get some really good people in, and they've made some really great changes. I teach every summer just about, so they make changes while I'm teaching using Submitty. So, you know, it's a two-edged sword. But yeah, Google Summer of Code is something that our individual projects get involved with, not necessarily Arcos as a whole. Although that's actually a really good idea. I hadn't really taken it that direction.
That's good. So we generally close with four questions. And the first of those is, are there any questions we haven't asked that you would like us to address or you'd like to answer?
You know, you guys are really thorough. You hit pretty much every question I thought you could ask me in a few in addition. I think maybe the only thing that I would like to add is, you know, I've been saying about 200 students. We've been doing this since 2007 was the first year we actually had students. It's grown from 12 people at that point to, 250 last fall, 190 this spring. We've had, over 1,500 students, not all of them unique, through the program. And, it's been really a great experience for us.
So the next is blockchain. Anything around blockchain? That's kind of our control question.
That is a so not this semester. Almost every other semester we've had something around blockchain since 2016 or so. This semester, the summer semester, we generally have a smaller set of projects. But yeah, there's always somebody looking to either use blockchain to validate something else, or use or come up with a new blockchain algorithm. We had one person in this fall last semester do a blockchain wallet where you could store your blockchain securely. So yeah, we have that's one of the technologies that the students are really intrigued by. We also have a lot on the stock market, by the way, students trying to figure out how to get rich. AI in the stock market.
That's on our back channel here. It got, so it says best blockchain answer yet. So that's good. You win. There's a little prize. And last but possibly or not least, what's your favorite text editor and scripting language?
I teach Python, so I like Python, although I will second it with Bash and VI all the way, or Vim now, I guess.
You're a VI guy. No Emacs here. Well, thanks so much, Wes. This has been really, really great having you on the show here. And I'd like to check back again later and see what progress there might be. So anytime. Thanks again on behalf of all of us.
This was fun.
Great. So, Simon, how did that work for you?
Well, that's all very interesting indeed. I love the concept of the course. Very creative curriculum idea. Very creative way for getting students to get credit for their courses. And I love the fact that it's so practical, that it's turning out people who have actually got the skills and experience that they need to do things. It would be great to see something like this popping up in more academic courses, because a lot of computer science is training students for a world that doesn't seem to exist anymore, a world where you write algorithms from a book of algorithms, and a world where all the software is written from scratch, and not a world where you stand on the shoulders of giants and innovate with all of the basic stuff done before by the people that you're collaborating with. So I would love to see this more widely implemented. Yeah. And I took particular note from Wes that it started out by a seed gift from a benefactor. And I wonder whether there are people who have benefited from open source out there who would be well-placed making specifically targeted gifts and endowments to make open source happen in more universities around America and around the world.
That would be a good thing. I was talking yesterday to an economist who said there's actually a lot of money laying around in the world that wants to do philanthropic and generous things. And we're tending to think, because business activity is a bit down right now, that that's not the case. But that was encouraging too. That was a new one on me that they got this gift. I think that's great. And I just love that openness and open source is being taught in a formal way, in a formal curriculum, because so much of computer science and so much of a lot of engineering work and stuff like that, has gone into the proprietary world. How let's fill the world with patents, and I'm going to get one, and I'm going to make money off of that. And that the virtues of open source itself are being taught. I think it's just great. Yeah.
Do you think that you would gossip this to the folks at the universities that you work with and say, why haven't you done this yet?
I was thinking about that, and I was thinking, there's some more technical than others, but I'm actually thinking, what are the equivalents at Southampton, at Harvard, NYU, UCSB in Indiana. Those are the ones that I'm where I'm hanging out. Like I said, as a planetary.
Well, I'd be very happy for you to get something started at those five. That would be enough, Doc.
that would be good. But I mean, it's a wonderful model. I really like what Wes is trying to do. So, do you have anything to plug there, Simon?
You know, I am completely wireless these days. I'd love to plug things. I would love people to show up on my Patreon and sponsor me, but I can't remember when that last happened in this world. So there's very little to plug at the moment. Keep on, you know, clicking on the links if you're watching on the video, or go to meshinsights.com or follow me on Twitter, or I've showed up on Instagram recently. Follow me on Instagram if you like. I'm there on GitHub if you want to see what I don't do on GitHub. It's all under the tag of Webmink, WebMink. You'll find me in all those places. Well, how about so you, Doc? What are you plugging in?
Where did the mink come from? I've known you for 20 years, and I don't know where that came from.
Is it
the animal or what?
It's no longer cool. back when I did it, it was relatively cool. But unfortunately, since then, the gentleman who drew the cartoon has demonstrated that he doesn't deserve our respect. But it was from a Dilbert cartoon around about 20 years ago. And it's the one that shows a weasel in the boardroom, and he's up next to the pointy head boss whispering in his ear, whisper, whisper, whisper. And the pointy head boss says, I've brought on a weasel to help us with our business planning. And the weasel goes over and whispers in his ear some more and says, I'm sorry, did I say weasel? I should have said mink.
That's excellent. I actually, rather than promote anything I'm involved with, I just want to give a hat tip toward Dave Weiner, who's working on something right now called Little Outliner. And he's the guy who kind of invented outlining more than 30 years ago. And it's always been a big part of my life. And I've kind of gone in and out of using Little Outliner, which is not a generally available thing as far as I know. But just watching what he does, he's at scripting.com, and he invented RSS as we use it today, without which you wouldn't have syndication or podcasting. He's one of the unsung heroes, or the insufficiently sung heroes of the internet. So, and he's a good friend. And so I just want to tip my hat in his general direction because of the endlessly good work that he does. So that's about it, I think. So thanks so much for being with us. I was trying to look and see what we've got coming up next week. Oh, Brian Deere. Okay.
We've got, I think, Brian Behlendorf coming up.
Brian Behlendorf is coming up. I am not.
It's going to be
Brian Deere and then Brian be. And then Brian. So Brian's on the 12th and, Brian. Yeah, he's on the 19th, and Brian is next week. Brian, there are two Brians. It's a throw
Brian
off there. But he has something called Brian Storms. But he, if you remember, Plato. He worked with Plato and wrote a book about Plato, which is of historic importance, it's quite a comprehensive one. But he does much more than that too. So he's an interesting guy. So I'm looking forward to that.
I'm helping you on the 19th with the show with Brian Behlendorf.
And you're helping me on the 19th. I do have you down there.
I know the people in the chat room are going to be very excited by this because Brian is the executive director of the blockchain project at Linux Foundation.
Right.
And the show is – if you are taking a shot every time we mention blockchain, you will be paralytic and in need of medical attention by the end of that show.
Game that we'll all lose, I suppose.
Yes.
So that's great. Well, thanks so much, and thanks for being with us on another Floss Weekly.
Want more TWiT? Check out Tech News Weekly, twit.tv/TNW. Tech News Weekly is a show where Jason Howell and I bring the latest and greatest interviews to you from the people making and breaking the tech news. twit.tv/TNW.